Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, making our final approach now with a guy who has thousands and thousands of hours as a pilot in some of the more dangerous places to fly. But before becoming a pilot, he was a bombardier in World War II, surviving 30 missions in B-24s and B-17s over Europe with the 487th Bomb Group. And I think we've learned surviving is definitely the appropriate word there. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, I have a link to his book with Neil Burkhart. It's called The Legend of Lieutenant Thompson. And if you read it, you'll learn about some of his many talents.
You know, a lot of guys who served on bomber crews have reminisced about some of the nose art on some of the plane, some more colorful than others. I don't know that I've ever talked to someone who was painting some of that nose art, though. That was one of your hidden talents?
Yep. I painted 4 different airplanes. And somewhere I've got a picture of me painting, and it says, the nose art artist, Denny Thompson. The first one was the Dragon Lady. Milton Caniff was a good friend of a young bombardier that was in our squadron, and he personally sent this big picture of the Dragon Lady, and I blew the picture up to about 10 feet long, and I'd chalk it in on the airplane. Then I'd paint what I could. We'd go on a mission, and generally you're in a rain somewhere, and it'd wash the chalk off. I'd have to keep painting that. Eventually I got it all painted, and I have pictures of it here somewhere in my junk.
What would you say was the most challenging aspect of being a bombardier for 30 missions over Europe?
Surviving, I would imagine. Yeah, because that was the ultimate. But you could very well see that you might not survive.
Uh-huh.
A lot of guys are taken prisoner, too.
Oh, yeah. I've talked to a lot of those guys.
Occasionally an airplane will blow up and nobody get out of it.
But you did survive. And it's a good thing, because if you didn't, none of your kids or grandkids would ever have been born.
Yep.
All these celebrities and tycoons wouldn't have had anyone to lead them around Alaska looking for big game.
Yeah. And I'm getting more popular as I get older, because there aren't anybody left. That's the whole thing.
Do you have a favorite story of all your hunting expeditions, or one particular exploit that gives you the most satisfaction?
I remember one exploit was when I had Fritz Carl Flick, which is the richest man in the world, and he just...
The guy you had bombed his property
bombed
in Germany.
Bombed his property.
Yeah.
Yeah, and probably quite a few of his properties. Anyway, he had just shot a Kodiak bear.
Uh-huh.
And it was a springtime, and the ice on the lakes was kind of rotten, and we landed with skis. And I was taken off with him, and we couldn't get airborne because it was mushy snow, and because I had a big bear hide in the back, and I had Fritz behind me. Well, eventually, we just couldn't go anymore. When we stopped, one ski went through the ice, and the other one stayed on the top, and then the wing stopped it out on this mushy ice out there. So I got out around the front of the airplane over the cowling, and I looked back, and Fritz is sitting back there. I said, Fritz, you ain't worth a bit more than I am right now. Get out of there. So he jumped out of there, and we were able to tread across the rotten ice and get over to shore, and I let him go ahead. I went back, got a hold of the bear hide, and dragged it out of there and dragged it across the ice. Then we switched airplanes because his private plane was waning in Anchorage, and he wanted to go to Austria bird hunting. So we changed airplanes, and eventually the same day I got him back to Anchorage, and his crew was all waning, and away they went. That was it. But that probably was one of the most interesting, but there were so many of them.
What are some of the names, some of the folks whose names we would recognize that you led on those hunting expeditions?
Carol Shelby, you know, hunted him, and Bob Peterson, Peterson Publishing Company, the mayor of Vienna, and I flew the president of France, Gustave Stang, in Africa. Jay Mellon, he was a billionaire.
And I guess another question that comes to mind for me, if what I'm looking at here in your home is just a fraction of the big game that you've hunted down, there had to be one or two that were more challenging than the rest. Was there ever a quest that was so difficult that when you finally accomplished it, it felt extra special?
Well, I was charged by a lot of polar bear. About 50% of them would charge, whether hit or not, because they had no enemies out on the ice. And I shot a lot of them, along with the hunter, that dropped right at our feet. And actually had snow spraying on us. And one got a hold of my pants leg one time. But I guided for about 350 polar bear and around 1,000 Kodiaks and grizzly bears.
Oof.
They weren't near as mean as the polar bears were. But we still had a few close ones from them.
What's more terrifying, bracing for the impact of flak you know you're about to fly through, or waiting to see if that bear stops before it gets to you?
I think the flak was, because you never knew where it came from. We made a movie of a bow hunter, a famous bow hunter, Art LaHaye. Anyway, we landed on this one big bear, and it was 44 below. We just called a radio station 100 miles in. It was a government station. They said it was 44 below, and it was blowing about 25 or 30 knots, and so it was cold. Well, we landed and put a cover on the engine and got all lined up to take movies, 16-millimeter movies and this kind of stuff out on the ice. We were 100 miles out on the Chukchi Sea. This is early when there was nobody else flying in the whole country. We were all by ourselves out there. Well, this bear was a big one. It was a good 11-footer. We put this Art LaHaye out about 30 feet in front of us with his bow and arrow. We wanted to shoot with an arrow. A native was with me. I had a shotgun, and I had my .375, and we were down behind the ice cakes looking out at where the bear is supposed to be, and I was trying to crank the lens on the camera so it zone in right or something. And we heard this Art LaHaye holler, "Here he comes, boys." And, well, we couldn't see or hear the twang of the bow, but apparently almost run over Art, and he let go of the arrow when he was right alongside of him. And that bear stopped. It was snow coming in my face, and I was behind an ice cake about this high on my knees. And that bear stopped right on top of that ice right there. And I looked up about where that light bulb is, and here his head's about that big around, and had his head cocked like that. Arrow was sticking out of the left-hand side, and there was blood coming down onto his paw, and he was looking right down at me. He was standing on the end of my .375. I kicked back, grabbed the .375, and kicked back, and was just turning it around to shoot him when this native alongside of me shot one shot with a 12-gauge shotgun with buckshot and blew one of his ears off. I forget which one. And that bear, instead of eating us, he stepped down off there. He stepped on top of that 16-millimeter camera. It was between my knees by that time, and my legs were stretched out. Drove it down into that hard snow and stepped across this leg. And about from here to one of those posts, I turned around and was going to shoot him from the rear end with that .375. And Art had come alive out there and was screaming, "Don't shoot him, boys. I want him to qualify for the Pope and Young Club," which is the record book for bows and arrows. So we didn't shoot him. We let him run off, but the wind was blowing. You can imagine 44 below and wind blowing 25, 30 knots is 30 miles an hour or more. Mm-hmm. And so we took out after him, and we never did catch sight of him. And these tracks got blown over, and it was late in the day. It was early in the spring, so your daylight wasn't very long. So we flew 100 miles back to shore and stayed with the natives back there. And the next morning, we flew back out, timed ourselves, and I'd be damned if we didn't come right onto that bear with the big bloody shoulder and everything. And anyway, we landed. He fired a couple of arrows. You can imagine that wind blowing like that. No effect, so I give him my .375, so he finally killed the bear. And that bear was made into a rug, and we showed movies to the Green Bay Packers and a lot of different people over the years.
Well, you've had quite a few adventures, sir, and you're looking forward to some more.
Nothing too exciting.
Why? What do you get out of going back to Normandy or going to England, as you're going to do soon, and putting on that uniform from World War II with all your decorations on it? What do you get out of all that?
I think the attention of the people. I think it's probably, and then just kind of just look the sky over in the shoreline, see that I remember it. But I think it's the attention of the people.
Do you
they
feel
are
like,
so nice. I mean, they, uh-huh. It's unbelievable.
Do you feel like you're representing your fellow veterans when you do that?
Yeah, I sure do.
And I guess that's the only other question I have is, what should we know? Those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't live through that, what should we know about the men that you served with?
Well, they were patriotic. Everybody that I knew just rushed to sign up. Of course, it was a lot of them went to Canada, but I didn't know any of them. Everybody I knew was right. Even my brothers went in before Pearl Harbor, and so we knew something was coming.
What would you say you're most proud of and most thankful for?
I think my military service. Yeah, no doubt about that. Because I never failed anybody, and I've kept busy ever since.
A lot of the 90-plus-year-olds that I interview still drive, but you do a little more than drive. You chop wood?
Oh, yeah, I drop trees.
Uh-huh.
Just dropped one yesterday morning, the one you drove between there, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I give stove wood to about four or five other old people. One's a Vietnam vet, and there's a couple old ladies up the hill. I give them wood.
So you chop down your trees and provide firewood for your neighbors?
Yeah. I don't chop down live trees. But these dead ones, it's a good thing to get them down because the beetles will go from one to the other. That's why you see so many clumps of these dead trees.
Yeah.
And as soon as I see it, a big dead one, I drop it. I got one to go out here. I just like to, I enjoy doing it.
Do you know any other 94-year-olds who do that?
Nope. Ones I know are burning my wood. Yeah. Yeah.
For a guy who has experienced so many things that a lot of other people would pay big money to have a chance to experience themselves, is there something you haven't done yet that you're still waiting on, still looking forward
nope.
to?
Nope. No, there sure ain't. Happy the way I am.
I heard you got to go on an honor flight.
Yeah, and that was great. And they kept us there 3 days.
Yeah.
It wasn't some of these, they go one day and they're back the same
yeah,
day.
East of the Mississippi, that's yeah. what they do.
And this old guy and his wife come up to me and they said, are you the bus driver? We're supposed to be on the bus. I had my uniform and all these medals on and everything. I laughed at that.
That's
yeah, that
good.
Was kind of funny.
What was the highlight of that experience for you?
I'd say probably the highlight is when we come in the middle of the night to San Francisco, and there must have been 500 people there.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
I see it's still going on. A lot of people, bands and everything, greeting them when they come back.
Yep. You don't strike me as an overly sentimental guy, but standing there at the World War II Memorial and seeing that wall of gold stars, 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, did you have the thought, I could have been part of one of those?
I'm sure I did. Didn't get carried away about it. I know that, but I just know I was luckier than hell.
I'd say so.
Yeah, you'd have to be.
You may not have known at the time, but now you know what was happening in those concentration camps all over. To know that you and your fellow veterans had a hand in bringing that to a stop and saving so many lives, is that something that gives you satisfaction now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, we went to, at Munich, we went to the Dachau. Went through Dachau. Pretty sad thing, I'll tell you. The big crematories and stuff like that. And that was quite an experience. We went to Hitler's, what do you call that big the house on the top of the hill?
The Eagle's Nest?
Yeah, the Eagle's Nest.
Yeah.
And I put my uniform on, particularly to go to the Eagle's Nest. And so we went up by bus, and it about caused a riot when I put the uniform on down at the bottom. Yeah, because there's a lot of Germans there, too.
Uh-huh.
They weren't mad. They were just excited.
I could see how that might be a little exciting, and if you'd like to see a 94-year-old Denny Thompson in his World War II uniform, maybe you want to order his book, written with Neil Burkhart, The Legend of Lieutenant Thompson. I have a link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. It's even available on Kindle. We're out of time today. Big thanks to Chase Anderson of Friends and Neighbors Magazine for connecting me to Denny. I have a link to Chase's article on this remarkable 94-year-old online for you as well. Next time, we're going to meet a 96-year-old survivor of the Battle of the Bulge who plays bocce ball every week in San Francisco and just can't wait to renew his driver's license when he turns 99. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.